This series is brought to you with the kind support of Wellington Management, one of the world's largest independent asset managers. Wellington believes in the importance of a diverse workforce, equitable opportunities for all colleagues to reach their potential, and an inclusive culture.
Over the last probably 10 to 12 years, I say that it's always a journey, right? I don't have a before and after story. I'm always tinkering with my identity, always questioning my identity. Am I comfortable where I'm at? Am I comfortable with my level of hormones? So I'm still on the journey and I started it a while ago, but it's always evolving for me, especially as new language comes out. I always examine when I hear like non-binary, I'm like, well, maybe I'm non-binary. And I look at those words and try to really think about it because I didn't know what I was until I had the words to say it, right?
Ethan Devitt, and welcome to the 50 Faces podcast Pride Special, in which we are celebrating the career journeys of LGBTQ plus professionals. I'm joined today by Leo Caldwell, who's an inclusion educator and consultant at Empathy by Design and an assistant lecturer at Ball State University School of Journalism, where he teaches visual communication courses in the journalism department. He also teaches podcasting and strategic social media communication in the graduate program at Drexel University. Welcome, Leo. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with your career journey, maybe how you came to your current role.
Yeah, so I've had a very, very interesting, winding career journey. I started in newspapers in the newsroom, loved it, and eventually was there for 6 years, moved up to senior editor, loved being in the newsroom, but as we know, newspapers are suffering and have been suffering for a while. And so the writing was on the wall. This wasn't going to last long. So I left the industry and I moved over into the learning and development industry for about 7 years and worked for a small boutique agency. And we had pharmaceutical clients, we had diagnostic clients, and I built a lot of basically corporate training for life sciences and sales reps. So really kind of a big dramatic switch from where I was at. And through all this, I'd finished my master's and I knew I wanted to teach in higher ed at some point. I just didn't really know the path there to how to get into higher ed. So in 2017, I was asked to teach at my alma mater, teach online. And I was like, okay, yeah, let's do this. Started teaching online and also still working my full-time job as a developer and instructional designer at the learning and training job. And so taught online for 5 years, 4 to 5 years, and then lived in New Jersey. And I started trying to apply to local colleges and then eventually started teaching at Drexel online as well. And as much as I like to teach online, I really wanted to be in the classroom interacting with students. So ended up, we had a big life change in 2021. And me and my family were able to leave New Jersey and come back to Indiana, where I'm from. And when we moved back, I applied for a full-time position in person to teach. And so now that's where I'm at. I love it. I'm an assistant lecturer of media design in the School of Journalism. And what I really love is that I'm in class with students now. So I'm actually able to connect with them, give them advice on their career paths, hook them up with internships. So I actually get to see faces with names. And I really love the role. And I'm one of the few out faculty members and definitely one of the only trans members in this building. And so I've had a couple different students, you know, come to my office just for that reason, just to connect with a trans person that is well into their career.
Well, that's wonderful. There's a lot to unpack there. And certainly it's no surprise that a communication specialist would like to communicate in person. I can totally understand that. Also curious, my own daughter is studying journalism. When you look at, say, when you're teaching journalism today for the students coming into your classroom, where is your focus? Where do you think the journalists of tomorrow will be operating, say, across digital format? Like it won't be the traditional newsroom, perhaps. How will they be using their skills?
What we're seeing is a lot more freelance, a lot more contract roles. They do everything, right? So they take the photos, they make the graphics, they write the story. And that's kind of the expectation. I specifically teach the visual communications portion. So we focus on graphics and visuals. And what we're seeing and what I was expected to do was everything. And so that's kind of what we're focusing on is making them, you know, they are a newsroom. This individual becomes the entire newsroom. Editors as well, right? And so the future for me of journalism is a couple of things. We have to teach them how to find good sources. And unfortunately, with the internet and the way things are right now, that's one of actually the biggest obstacles is to teach unbiased writing, to teach focused in clear writing, but also to know where you're getting your sources from. And when someone says something is a fact, double check it, right? And this is a generation that grew up with the internet, so they're pretty savvy, but there's still a lot of things that come through the system, you know, that they'll turn in for a grade. And I'm like, I don't know if this is right. You know, I don't know if this is true. Where did you get this from? And so just really teaching them. And even at this point, it's sometimes difficult for me to track down, where did this come from? And is that source reputable?
It's so interesting. And we're going to plunge into the other aspect of the work you do in terms of some of the counseling and the consulting that you do. But just before we leave the topic of journalism, I've had some previous podcast guests, not in this series, but other series, who talk a little bit about the resilience you have to build in media, just how grueling it can be at the beginning. Essentially, the sort of the long hours, the bottom of the totem pole type of pay, the always on call type of expectation. Do you still see that? And how do you coach students to kind of learn to live with that?
Yeah, for me, you know, I definitely had that experience. I remember I had two phones, right? I had my work phone and I had my personal phone. And my work phone, I mean, I would go into a movie and be nervous about being in the movie because what if news broke, right? And I was in charge of updating the website, and it was really important that we were first. So there was a lot of pressure and a lot of late nights, as you spoke about. Now, to be honest, for me personally, I'm pushing more boundaries. And yes, it's an industry that you do always have to be on. But I actually, when I ran a digital desk towards the end of my career, and one of my biggest things was making sure we had enough staff so that we didn't feel like we couldn't go to a movie. Because I think that's a part of what's come out of the pandemic is setting personal boundaries, protecting your mental health. And I think journalism is an area that is not spoken about a lot and definitely not preached. And so that's something I try to instill in my students that, yeah, you need to be there, you need to show up, but you also need time that rests and time that's yours. And one of my big struggles early on was recognizing that I also needed that. And once I did, trying to implement that with my own staff when I had one.
And some really interesting points you made earlier about, I suppose, the definition of truth and the sliding scale now between fact and opinion. I think it's probably one of the most interesting times to be a journalist, particularly with our constant news cycle as well.
Definitely.
Let's move now to talk about the theme of LGBTQ+ representation. So a theme of this whole podcast series is representation within professions. Tell us about your own transgender journey before we talk about some of the learnings you've taken from that.
Yeah, so I grew up in a small town in Indiana, and then, you know, I was a high schooler in the 90s. So the idea of transgender, trans man, I didn't even know these words, right? This language wasn't even accessible to me. At the time, the only representation I saw was mostly through sensationalized talk shows. The word transsexual was used a lot. And so I didn't really know a version of being transgendered that felt accessible or possible. So I didn't identify as transgendered in my youth. I actually identified as a lesbian. I grew up Pentecostal, so very religious with very strict standards. So I knew that was going to be an issue. And I knew that my family was not going to be super supportive. So it took me a while to come out. I came out when I was 21 as a lesbian, and then took me even longer really to embrace the transgender journey because I wasn't sure what that was. I didn't know what that looked like. There was no representation for me. There was no reference point. And so I remember I actually would go to the gay bar and I met a trans man there once. And I was like, oh, this is a thing. This is an option. And so this was probably like when I was 25, right? And so I started seeking things out on the internet. This is before social media. So I'm going on to messaging boards. I'm ordering books and just trying to find what I can. I remember I eventually got a Netflix account because you could order the DVDs. And that was the only way I could access anything that represented me at all. So it was really a scavenger hunt to find my identity. And then when I was in my late 20s, I went back to college because I had originally, you know, started college after high school and dropped out because of all the things I was dealing with personally as an LGBTQ+ person in the Midwest and coming out, and just wasn't a great time for me to be focused on school. I was focused on existing. And so then in my late 20s, I went back to school and I had access to therapy and worked with a therapist here, but it was 2009 at this point, and the standards of care, they were really prescriptive and they were really uniform. There wasn't a lot of room for you to like have a transgender journey that didn't look like the way the medical professionals said it should, right? And so I did not want to go on hormones, but I had to access hormones in order to have surgery, to get the letter for surgery. That's what my therapist was requiring of me. So I did a lot of like, again, negotiations that looking back, kind of upsetting that I had to do. But once I did get access to the things I wanted, I lived my life, again, in a small town as a transgender person and an out one as well. And I think what I started to see is that a lot of people just had never been around a trans person, or not knowingly would have been around a trans person. And by just being visible, I was starting to change opinions and thoughts, and it was really powerful. And so, yeah, over the last probably 10 to 12 years, I say that it's always a journey, right? I don't have a before and after story. I'm always tinkering with my identity, always questioning my identity. Am I comfortable where I'm at? Am I comfortable with my level of hormones? So I'm still on the journey, and I started it a while ago, but it's always evolving for me, especially as new language comes out. I always examine when I hear like non-binary, I'm like, well, maybe I'm non-binary. And I look at those words and try to really think about it, because I didn't know what I was until I had the words to say it, right?
That is so interesting. And I think very intuitive to think about this as a journey. And also society, I suppose, is on a journey too, in terms of how it copes with new language and new concepts, and I suppose more acceptance. If you were to look, you're in the Midwest now, which is, I think, particularly relevant, perhaps, given that the perhaps acceptance and transgender rights are not universal throughout the United States. What would you say society is getting right and getting wrong right now in terms of how it works with transgender individuals?
Well, I think generally I'm seeing a lot more support and outrage against the things, like we're seeing a lot of anti-trans legislation across the country, and we see it grow every year, right? And before, when I would see these things, I didn't see a lot of people talking about it in my feeds. I didn't hear a lot of my friends asking how I was, right? There was not a lot of awareness around what was happening to the community. And now I'm seeing a lot more awareness. I'm seeing a lot more action from allies and from folks around. So I feel a lot more seen. I feel a lot more, I want to say protected, but I actually hesitate to say that because there is so much anti-trans legislation. I feel like there are people fighting for me now, where I didn't necessarily feel that before. I felt like there were a lot of folks coming up against me and not a lot of people understanding that was the case, right? And so now, even though every single year since 2019, the anti-trans legislation literally has doubled from 2020, it was double what it was in 2019. And now this year, it's expected to double from 2021. Even though I'm seeing that and it's terrifying, I feel uplifted by the fact that, yeah, the other side is getting louder and they're getting more bold, but my side is growing in numbers. And I feel like our army is growing in numbers. And so we have a big fight out there, but we're vocal and we're supported.
And in terms of some of the things that are going right, I suppose, there's certainly more awareness of inclusion, the need for inclusion in the workplace, more visible displays, say, of allyship, not only in Pride Month, but all year round. Can you talk about what your experience of inclusion is and perhaps what more we need to do to improve that?
To be honest, the most eye-opening thing for me was I actually worked in a Midwestern newsroom as a lesbian, and then I got a job in an East Coast newsroom. And so within 2 weeks, you know, I told the editor, I was like, look, when I come out there, I want to be Leo. So I went from working as a woman in the workplace to 2 weeks later, working as a man in the workplace. And that right there, talk about gender experience and seeing the inequality. When I was a woman, I would sit in meetings with several other people and I just felt not heard. I would say things and they would kind of be brushed aside. And then later, maybe someone would remember it. And I just didn't feel visible or heard. I go out to the East Coast and I'm a man now. I'm wearing ties and I'm being introduced to everybody important that comes into the office. I get promoted within a year to a senior, like just really excelled quickly. I'm the same person, right? But visually and socially now I'm viewed as a man. And I was not out as a trans man then. I actually just went stealth, which I tried for a little bit and I hated it because I do not want to be. I'm like, okay, I'm not digging just being a regular cis dude. It's not my jam. And so I saw the inequality really, really clearly just in the daily interactions. And of course, I don't have like data around it, but just the feeling of being a woman in the newsroom versus being now a man in the newsroom was just a totally different experience. So we have so much more work to do there. But as far as being a trans person and in what it means to be inclusive, I actually have a really also a very interesting perspective. I worked for a family-owned agency when I did the learning and development work, and they were based in Indiana. It was ran by a husband and wife. I came in. I was obviously the first trans employee. They didn't know a lot about trans people. They educated themselves. They read books, and then they became really vocal. They would use our company platform, like when there's the thing around trans military folks. I can't remember the ban on people being trans in the military. They put a public statement out as the company and said, we support transgendered military individuals and we support transgendered individuals in general. And they just did that a lot. They would send me a card if something was going down that felt uncomfortable on a national level. So that felt really inclusive. I felt seen. I felt supported. They actually sold their company in 2009 to a larger company of about 250 people. Again, it was supposed to be an environment of inclusion. That was one of the questions they asked about diversity and inclusion because they care a lot about it. And it gave you the impression, the company gave you the impression, we had values on the wall that this was going to be a safe space. Soon as I started there, the Supreme Court case about workplace protections was being heard down in the Supreme Court, and I was going down there. So I posted in our Yammer group, hey, I just want everybody to know this is being heard. This is a really important case for your LGBTQ plus colleagues. This means that we would have federal protections. Like, yay, you know, they care about this. Well, within a few hours, I got an email from the CEO and he was like, hey, I just want you to know all companies, probably not a good place to post that. That's a political issue. You should post it in the D&I. Like, it was basically a D&I group, but it was all people that were underrepresented or underserved. And so I was really disappointed and shocked. So then I started getting involved in the D&I stuff and really showing up and kind of going toe to toe with the CEO, which is not an awesome thing to do when it's a new company and you're trying to, you know, I wanted to be promoted. I wanted to make more money. And here I am challenging him at every turn when it comes to D&I and how we approach it. But what it really came to an issue for me was I went on leave when the pandemic happened to take care of my son. And then, you know, the whole Black Lives Matter movement elevated with the George Floyd killing. And I was waiting for a statement from them that had meaning and had meat, and it didn't. Their statement was very bland. And I was like, I came back from leave and I quit within a week. And I sent a long email to my CEO and I said, here are the things that have happened while I've been here that have made me uncomfortable as a trans person. And I outlined them and I said, you're in a place of power. You could help us. Please do better. And he wrote back, I hope you find what you're looking for. And so that experience really showed me the contrast between what it feels like to be supported and included and to feel seen versus to be dismissed.
So interesting. I also would imagine there are some sort of a statement, for better or worse, it seems some companies simply cannot get to the point of making a statement like that. But there are also practical changes that perhaps are less public, but also equally important, say the gender neutral bathrooms. Would you agree that there are certain smaller changes that can be practical that can also contribute to that type of an environment practically?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. There's policies, right? You can write, we had no policies around discrimination, or their whole thing is that they were big into values and not policies. And my argument behind that is that a lot of times values end up uplifting the people that are already in power versus policies that protect people that aren't, right? So I think creating policies that are specific to discrimination and harassment and or policies around, okay, you have a trans employee, what do I do now? How do I change my name? What's the process? And even if those are just HR policies, right, that aren't employee facing. But that's another thing that the company did, the one that was the small family owned. After some back and forth, they changed our bathrooms to gender neutral bathrooms and didn't cause any issue, right? And so, yeah, those sort of actionable things that even if you can't publicly make a declaration, you can definitely do smaller things internally. And I would say even if you can't publicly say something, you can definitely internally allow that dialogue to happen, allow safe space for that dialogue. And that actually never happened either at that company. I felt like anytime I spoke up, it was challenged by people that were in power, that were white cisgendered people. And I think just even creating a space where folks can say, hey, you know what, this feels bad or this happened, and making it so that the dialogue can happen is important.
And one of the most remarkable things I think about you that I've noticed on LinkedIn, some of your posts, is that you have taken incidents of bias and maybe painful discrimination. For example, some group that refuses to use your chosen pronouns or refuses to recognize new status, et cetera, and use those as teachable moments to maybe see that as an opportunity for some coaching, perhaps, or some consulting. Can you talk about some of that you've done?
Yeah, I joke. I said, I'm turning my trauma into cash. So the thought is, whenever I go into the world, right, my legal name is still my name that I was given at birth, right? So it's still a very female sounding name. And I intentionally kept it that way for the last 10 years for these teachable moments. So when I go and interact into the world, there's always an opportunity that pops up. So I've had instances, especially around the medical community, where I am a trans man, so I still have to get pap smears. And going into a gynecology office is not very comfortable. And I've been challenged at the front desk, like, why are you here? You don't need to be here. And I'm like, I have an appointment. I'm here. And so when these moments happen, of course, they're very painful and awkward in the moment for me. But as I go through the moment, I think to myself, one, I don't want someone else to deal with this. And so the other thing is, okay, you need training. I have a training background. So I've taken those moments and I get a hold of the office manager and I say, hey, I had this experience and it was not good. It felt really bad. But guess what? I do this work. So if you want to change that so other people don't feel this way when they come into your office, here's the presentation. Here's what I can offer you. So giving people an opportunity to, you know what? You messed up, but here's a way you can change. And I've had some folks take that and run with it. I've had people say, you know what? We're not ready for that right now. And I try to push back and say, well, you're going to need to be because Gen Z is the most gender diverse population and they're entering adult life now. And so we're going to see organizations, offices, customer facing businesses need to be prepared to deal with these situations. So yeah, anytime I can, I'm not always in the mood for it, but most times if I can make it a teachable moment, I try to. And that's what I felt like with the company that hired me after the family owned one. I was like, oh, this is a moment for me to teach, you know, and for me to say, hey, these are some ideas. This is what we can do different. And that's what I did for 9 months, but I can't do it for any longer than 9 months. And that's when I was like, I'm done. So yeah, I think, again, it's a joke about turning trauma into cash, but it is actually rooted more so because for a long time, I did this stuff for free, but it's more rooted in, I don't want the next person that walks into that room to have that experience if they're trans.
I often think sometimes minds get changed. It's not by blanket tactics. It's by hand-to-hand combat almost. It's like these one-on-one discussions with people you know is how you really overcome bias because then people realize that we're just people and that it may be something a headline they're reading isn't necessarily what translates. I'd also like to just go back to something you said about how you saw the difference in your status when you came to work as a man. And that you saw, realized how much perhaps you had been discriminated against or other women were discriminated against in the workplace. What did that make you want to do differently, I suppose, around all workplaces and inclusion there?
Yeah, I mean, just being hyper aware, one, as now a male presenting coworker, that when a woman is speaking, that the attention is given to that woman. I just think that there's so many instances where I felt honestly like talked over a lot and I, you know, just shutting my mouth or making sure that if a person is talking and others are talking, can we pay attention to what this woman is saying? Because I think that's, again, it's a one little instance, but if we listen to women and shut our mouths, then maybe we would be in a better spot, right? And it's not a policy change and it doesn't change the fact that there's a wage gap, but it's that idea that if your voice isn't even being heard, how are we going to change it and center those people? And so that's one of my big focuses is there's actually a funny website. I forget what it's called. How much are men talking or something? And you can track in a meeting what percentage women are talking versus men. And so I've thought about that, like start tracking in our meetings, like how often is it a man speaking versus a woman? And just that idea of hearing the voices of women and elevating the voices of women. Because to be honest, that for me was the big difference, was how much my voice was elevated now that I was a man.
Such an interesting perspective. And of course, trans women may have the opposite experience in terms of their views not being taken as seriously, perhaps, versus when they were representing as a man. So I think it can be interesting to have both sides. You're in a very unique position. Just going back now to your own journey, would you say there were any key people along that way who were either great allies or really made a difference in your career and how you saw the world?
Yeah, I had a mentor here at Ball State and she's still here. And I love it because like we're going to end up doing research together. I'm like, how cool that this person, when I was in college, encouraged me so much. Jennifer Paulonis, Dr. Paulonis. And she was one of the first people, it wasn't even related necessarily to my transgender journey, just saw the potential and really encouraged my potential. And then once I started coming out, I wasn't yet out as trans. And once I did, she was just like, great. And even the fact that she didn't make a huge deal of it, which I loved, that made me feel just like it normalized the journey for me, which I needed it at the time. And so she's been a great influence to me. And then my first editor, Lisa Savage, she was very direct and very much like, you have talent, you've got to do this. But also very bossy, which I loved. And it gave me a sense of like strength. And I was quiet and shy. And just her confidence really rubbed off on me and just being mentored by her, kind of like a take no bullshit motto. And I really needed that, especially going out into a New Jersey newsroom from an Indiana one. I really needed that attitude.
There's so many characters in the world of media. I love to hear about stories like that. Speaking of mottos, is there any creed or motto that you live by or any key piece of advice that you've been given that you'd like to share here?
I get a lot of young trans people asking me, well, you know, my parents don't accept me. This is happening. And I always tell them, find people that celebrate you. I surround myself around people that celebrate me, not just love me. I want love, yes. I want to be celebrated. And if you can find, especially as a trans person, I mean, we have so many people in the world that hate us for existing and we don't even know these people. So the people in your inner circle have to be people that love and celebrate you. And if they don't, they're not in your circle. They're not in your inner circle. So for me, it's I always try to find those folks that are wanting to celebrate me.
I love that. And now looking back at your younger self, if you could give that person any advice, what would you say?
I would say be less afraid. Make hard choices that might hurt others' feelings, because I made a lot of choices based on how it would make someone else feel. And a lot of times it wasn't intentional that they were hurt. And so I made a lot of choices that weren't good for me. So I wish that I would have made choices that were a little more bold, even if it was at the cost of hurting someone for a little bit.
Well, thank you so much, Leo. It was LinkedIn and social media that brought me to you, and your joy and the way you celebrate your life and the people around you and take your learnings to really lift others up, I think was a real inspiration and continues to be. It is very affirming. And as I said, very joyful. So thank you for coming here and sharing your insights with us.
Thank you so much for having me and letting me have the space to share my journey.
I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to the 50 Faces podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring people and their personal journeys, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest. 'Cause I was made to be free.